And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable. And our special guest today is Jeff Apter. And listeners will remember Jeff's previous stellar appearances on Dads on the Air when we've talked about his books on John English, George Young of the Easy Beats, and Malcolm Young of AC/DC. Jeff is the author of more than 30 music biographies, including those on the Bee Gees and the Finn Brothers, and he's heard regularly on ABC Radio Sydney. Today we get to talk to Jeff about his most recent book, Bad Boy Boogie, the true story of AC/DC legend Bon Scott. Jeff, welcome back to Dads on the Air.
It's good to be back, Bill. Good to be talking with you again.
Jeff, as you've been working through the stories of the of AC/DC's members, and you've come across some pretty taciturn Scots, it must have been something of a relief to settle on the eminently quotable Bon Scott.
Yeah, well said. It was much easier in a lot of ways. It was a case of what to leave out rather than trying to find material to squeeze in. So yeah, you're right. He was eminently quotable, both on the record and on the record, the vinyl record, in his interviews and in his many stage appearances. It was a lot of fun to write. As tragic as the story ultimately is, he squeezed a lot of living into those 33 years.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that he was a prolific writer, wasn't he? I mean, he was writing what turned out to be lyrics in his notebook all the time, but he was also sending a lot of letters to people he'd come in contact with.
Yeah. He regarded himself as a sort of a street poet. I think he called his lyrics toilet poetry, but he was understating his case, I think. I was really lucky. During the course of the writing of the book, I reached out to a woman named Mary Renshaw, who was a good friend of Bond's for many, many years, and one of the many people that he would communicate with via letter. He was an inveterate letter writer, and she gave me access to a number of letters that he'd written to her over the last probably 5 or 6 years of his life, when he was pretty much in motion with the band. They were touring all the time. They were in Europe, they were in the UK, they were in America, constantly in motion. But he'd always find the time to stop and reflect. He would have been great in the era of email and the web, I think. He would have been just constantly online, this guy. He was... I think he was probably a little homesick. You know, most of his letters were to people back in Australia who he was... It was always a case of, can't wait to catch up with you, I'll be back at Christmas, you know, how's things going, can we get together? In his letters, he had the opportunity, I guess, to really grandstand and talk about how famous the band was becoming, but he very rarely did that, interestingly. It was more personal stuff, you know? How are you? How's the family? When can we catch up? You know, I'm homesick, I want to get home and meet you. All that kind of stuff, so... It revealed a far more personal side of the guy. He could also be really funny. I mean, all his Christmas cards were signed off with the farewell jingle balls, which was very Bon Scott, I thought. But, you know, his sense of humour was always prominent. But it revealed a kind of more thoughtful and sensitive side of the guy that very few people are aware of.
He probably didn't get too many letters in return because he was pretty much no fixed address, wasn't he?
With he all was, the touring. Yeah. He was, I think the quote was, I'm courtesy of no fixed address and Angus lives upstairs. You know, they were constantly in motion. It's amazing the work ethic of these guys. And not just with AC/DC. Keep in mind, too, that Bon had been in other bands. He'd been in the Valentines in the 60s, who were a kind of bubblegum pop band coming out of Western Australia. And then he was in a band called Fraternity, who were based in Adelaide, but spent quite a bit of time in the UK. They were kind of a prog rock band who modelled themselves on the band, Bob Dylan's backing band, for a long time. So, you know, for 15 years of his life, from the mid-60s to his death, he was constantly in motion, always on the road, always touring. But AC/DC, yeah, their work schedule was mapped out 12 months in advance. They'd play 300 shows a year, record one, maybe two albums, do all those public appearances that are required. It was phenomenal work, a phenomenal output. And, yeah, the guy, he had a real gypsy spirit. I mean, the lifestyle suited him, but I think towards the end of his life he was starting to really dream about base somewhere. He talked about buying a house. You know, it could have been in Sydney. It could have been on the moon. It could have been somewhere in America. But I think he was looking forward to just establishing some kind of base somewhere, because it was something he didn't have pretty much from his entire adult life.
Well, you describe him as the Joker in the AC/DC pack. What were some of his other roles in the group?
Well, I think that one was his prominent role. You know, well, because he was a lyricist, he was a vocalist, he was probably the main spokesman for the band when it came to media, because he was quick-witted. You know, Bond came out to me, he came out of this kind of era, and I think a really fun era in Australian cultural history. It's the era of the larrikin. It was, you know, Barry McKenzie, it was Paul Hogan, it was other musicians like Shirley Strawn, it was Ian Chappell and Dennis Lilly. You know, everybody was sort of anti-authoritarian. You know, they thumbed their nose at the establishment, and they liked to have a good time a lot of the time. They enjoyed a laugh, and, you know, they were quite a good raconteurs, I think is the best way of putting it. And that's certainly an environment that Bond came out of and I think really embraced. He gave so much character to AC/DC. As you said, the Youngs themselves, they could be a fairly dour bunch. You know, they took what they were doing, which was conquering the world, very, very seriously. And Bond was all in. You know, he was as ambitious as them, but at the same time, he had a really strong and prominent sense of humour, which exploited, and it really gave the band a lot of character. You know, you see them on Countdown. Those early appearances on Countdown are just priceless. You know, Bond dressed as, I've got to say, the ugliest schoolgirl you've ever seen in your life. You know, and immediately, the band was immediately identifiable all across Australia purely on those early Countdown appearances. So that was so important to the establishment of AC/DC.
And how would you rate him as a singer and a musician?
Oh, one of Australia's best. I mean, the simple fact that he's been gone for 40 years. Bond has been dead longer than he was alive, if I can put it in really simple terms. And yet he's still name-checked as, you know, one of the great rock and roll frontmen, vocalists and lyricists. All the current rockers, people like Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters and so on, all name-check Bon Scott as a huge influence. And it must be a bit of a load for Brian Johnson, you know, the new boy in AC/DC who's been there for 41 years. He's still sort of living in the shadow of Bon Scott. It's an enormous legacy. And as I say, I just think he's one of, you know, the fact that you see now supermodels wearing AC/DC T-shirts normally and most typically from that era of Bon Scott. And he was only in the band for 5 years. You know, it's phenomenal what he achieved in that time. And again, one of the great tragedies of his story, he didn't live to see this amazing legacy that he had as a you know, kind of a rock and roll, I don't know, larrikin, I think is the best way to describe it.
Yeah, well, he definitely lived up to the rock and roll lifestyle that's expected, I guess you'd say. But we're just going back to him being a joker. I mean, he even did it with the band when he told them all he could play the bagpipes. I mean, he is Scottish.
Well, this is, of course, during the recording of Long Way to the Top. And, you know, a stroke of genius on the part of their producers, George Young and Harry Vander. You know, we need something here. How about some bagpipes? And, of course, Bond, no pun intended, he piped up and said, oh, I can play the bagpipes. But the reality was he'd been a drummer in a pipe band back in Fremantle when he was growing up, him and his dad. And because, you know, he bluffed his way through it. And when they'd play live, he'd play to a recording. He'd actually blow into the mouthpiece of the bagpipe, but wouldn't actually play the pipes themselves. So, oh, yeah, he was a pretty good improviser. And, you know, there's a great story when they were opening for Skyhawks. It's about 1975, and it was very important that they make a big statement. AC/DC were great at blowing other bands off stage. They were good at targeting acts who they thought were the opposition, who they needed to get over, you know, to win over and to basically usurp. And they're playing a show second to Skyhawks, and they figured, well, we better do something here. And they had a couple of people dressed as policemen come on stage and, you know, seemingly arrest the band. And it went a bit wrong, and Bond tumbled into the crowd and got knocked out, and there was a bit of a fist fight on stage, and some gear got wrecked, and the Skyhooks roadie came into the dressing room after the show, and basically he had the tape that they used for the bagpipe solo on Long Way to the Top, and he had it in his hand, and he said, "You buggers." And he just put it under his foot and just crushed it to pieces. And Bond looked up. Bond, who was trying to recover from being knocked out, said, "Oh, no, he's killed our pipes." You know, so he certainly created a lot of mischief on stage, and sometimes was the sometimes came out the worse for wear. But, he certainly embraced the rock and roll lifestyle. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, I mean, looking back, it seems unlikely that he was in those different bands, but maybe it all added to it. I mean, the Valentines were a bubblegum sort of pop, and then he was in that earnest band called The Fraternity. Who played,
that's right.
Yeah, serious.
Well, they were all stepping stones, don't they? You know, he was definitely a square peg in all of those bands. I think what the situation was is, you know, when he started out, he really didn't know what his musical identity was. You know, the Valentines was an opportunity, and Bond was very good at grasping whatever opportunity came his way. And he tried to conform. You know, he tried to fit in. He wore the red satin outfits in Valentines, and he had the hippie look in Fraternity, and he tried his best to fit in. But it really wasn't until he met the Young Brothers in AC/DC, you know, one night in Adelaide in 1974. It dawned on Bond, this is what I should be doing. This is the kind of music I should be making, and this is the band that needs me.
Well, we're just about to get into that era, but it's about the this stage of the show where we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song, and I think you've got an obvious one for us, Jeff.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, Bad Boy Boogie. It's a 1977 song from the band. It's the title of the book. I don't think Bond was writing about himself when he wrote the lyric, but it pretty much fits with everything about the guy. To me, you know, again, larrikin spirit, a real Aussie kind of quality. A guy who was up for a good time most of the time.
And that was Bad Boy Boogie by AC/DC. And the singer on that track was Bon Scott, who is the subject of the new book by our guest today, Jeff Apter. The book is also called Bad Boy Boogie, the true story of AC/DC legend Bon Scott. So, Jeff, we were just at the stage. Poor old Bonds had some unpromising adventures. He was in jail at 18. He had motorbike accidents. He was 28 when a good thing happened.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there was, Bond really flew very close to the sun a few times, even before joining AC/DC, as you spelled out. He had a sort of reckless streak. The guy was a lot more intelligent. I mean, we give him credit for a lot more thoughtful and soulful in a lot of ways, but there was still this wild streak. And yeah, had a terrible bike crash, almost died. He did some time in jail when he was a teenager. You know, I did an interview with Angus, I think it was about year 2000. And whenever you interview anybody from AC/DC, inevitably talk turns to Bon Scott. And he said to me, you know, Bon used to swim with the sharks. And I thought he was talking figuratively. But as I found out while writing the book, no, he was actually speaking quite literally. Bond used to work on a crayfishing boat off Fremantle and just used to jump into the drink, not really concerned about what was around the boat at the time. So it sort of summed him up in a lot of ways that he took big bites of life. He was the kind of guy who, you know, the after party of a show would last right up until the next gig. There's this interesting, you know, fascinating contrast, personally, between him and Angus. When you put them on stage, they were this dynamic duo. But off stage, they couldn't have been more different people. You know, Angus was a teetotaler. Angus liked to, after a show, he liked to retire to his hotel room, play his guitar and smoke a lot of cigarettes, you know, and drink tea. That was his idea of a big night out. Mm. Whereas Bond, as I said, his idea of a big night out was one that went for about 3 or 4 days. So they're vastly different characters. But to put them on stage together, and there's this incredible chemistry, almost pretty much from the get-go, pretty much from the first time they got together. It was mid-1974. And, you know, this incredible chemistry in this, you rarely see it. You know, typically now with rock and roll bands, you've got a front man and the other guys. AC/DC had two very, very charismatic figures on stage, and it was such a big part of their, particularly their live act. And the big way of selling AC/DC to the world was the Bond and Angus show. And, you know, we wouldn't be talking about them today if it wasn't for that.
Yeah, they clicked. You've got those two great guitarists that were there, the brothers, Angus and Malcolm, and then Bond completed the picture by writing all these lyrics that
It was a perfect storm, wasn't it?
It was, and the lyrics went so well together. I mean, I suppose you compare, say, Elton John and Bernie Taupin or something like that, but they each stuck to their field. One, the boys were Angus and Malcolm were writing the music, and Bond was writing the lyrics, and they just went together.
It's fascinating, yeah, and they did work in isolation. You know, Malcolm and Angus, when they were recording, Malcolm and Angus would be in the studio with George Young and Harry Vander, you know, recording all these riffs and getting down all these musical ideas, and Bond would be buried away in this kit. They'd sometimes lock him in the kitchen because he tended to drift off, and he'd just be writing lyrics, and they just magically fitted. It's one of those great rock and roll chemistry things where somehow, even though Bond wasn't musically trained, apart from, you know, playing the drums in a Scottish pipe band, he somehow managed to write lyrics that just fit so well with these riffs and musical ideas that the young brothers were coming up with. It's, you know, it's Jagger Richards, it's Lennon McCartney, it's that kind of stuff. It's rare, but when it does happen, and as it did in the case of AC/DC, it's just timeless. I mean, it says so much that AC/DC will probably go back out on the road once the whole COVID situation has calmed down. And they'll be playing probably 50% of their songs will be Bon Scott era songs. He was only in the band for 5 years out of what's now a 45-year history. It's incredible the legacy that he's left behind. And like I say, it's all about that magic. Most of it happened in Sydney at Albert Studio, you know, which is, as I discovered while writing the book, it's now a car park. Mm. That great Australian tradition of honouring, you know, buildings of some significance. Turn them into car parks or apartment buildings, Bill. That's what we do. And, you know, but so much great music happened at Albert's Studio in Sydney. It's just a pokey little studio in the middle of the CBD. in an office complex. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like one of these great studios you see in California and LA where, you know, it's very obviously a significant recording studio. This was just a little hole in the wall. But some magical stuff happened there.
Is there a plaque or anything to talk about the history?
No, it's a, yeah, there is a plaque. Bill, it says hourly rates. I've got a friend of mine, Herm Kovac, a guy who, Herm's one of the co-founders of the Ted Murray Gang, and he said, I'm standing outside Albert's, I'll send you a photo, and it was a car park. It's, I mean, it did, Albert's studio relocated from Sydney, went over to Neutral Bay, so, you know, there are certain artifacts that still remain, but I don't know, I think we've got a terrible, you know, we being, you know, Australians collectively and governments have a terrible habit of ignoring places of significance. Yeah, you know, you go to New York and you could go to a dozen great rock and roll sites, even though they're no longer there. CBGB's, Andy Warhol's factory, all these places. You know when you get there, there's some kind of recognition of what this site was. We don't tend to do that in Australia. Even AC/DC Lane in Melbourne, it's a great thing, but it's not actually in a place that AC/DC frequented. You know, it would be more appropriate to have it in Sydney, somewhere near where the Albert Studio used to be.
Well, while Bon lived this wild lifestyle, there was another side to him, wasn't there? I mean, a lot of women surprisingly refer to him as being such a gentleman.
It was really surprising that, you know, there's this public image of Bon, this persona that he quite willfully developed himself, but the reality was he was there was a lot more to him. One story, and again, it was actually Herm Kovac who told me this story, and I thought it summed up Bon pretty interestingly. He said that they were backstage at an AC/DC show and Bon had just come off stage and he's dripping sweat and he's exhausted and he's probably, all he needs is a towel and a beer. And he noticed that Herm had a date with a woman with him. And the first thing he did was, I'll get you a chair. And he raced off and came back with a chair for this woman. I thought there was a chivalrous side to him, you know, and really almost an old-fashioned side. You know, Bon wrote a lot of lyrics that people on face value think were quite demeaning to women, like Whole Lotta Rosie and She's Got Balls and so on. But if, you know, he defended those songs. He said these are songs of praise. And if you look at them and listen to them a bit more closely, he was actually right. Whole Lotta Rosie, she might have been a big woman, but Bon really, you know, he speaks incredible, sings lyrics that are actually quite praiseworthy. He was incredibly fond of this woman, you know. So what if she was big? It just gave the song a bit more, I don't know, a bit more content, I guess. You know, and he said She's Got Balls was written for his ex-wife. He said, because she does. He was tougher than I was. She stood up to me, you know. So which I think it's very interesting, Bill, because recently the Rolling Stones have dropped Brown Sugar from their set list. You know, there was some commentary about the lyrics and how they're inappropriate and so on, which is probably very true. But I don't think AC/DC would be able to play anything. Yeah. if the same rules were applied to them, they'd have to drop every song from their set list. And yeah, I could only imagine what it would have happened if it was raised in the time of Bon Scott. He would have reacted to it in a very interesting way because he defended a lot of his lyrics. And I actually came across a letter where he, I think it was in relation to the song She's Got Balls, and he said, I can't wait till the women's libbers get their hands on this one. So he was aware of what was going on in the bigger outside world. And at the same time, he was quite willing to defend what he wrote because it wasn't what it appeared on face value.
One thing you talk about at one stage in the book is that he had some plans for a solo record in the US, which I was amazed at because the Young Brothers wouldn't be keen about letting anyone go off and do their own thing, I'd imagine.
Yeah, well, it could have spelt the end of Bond's spell out the front of AC/DC. They were very, very protective of their domain. I mean, they sacked their manager, Michael Browning, for a number of reasons, one of them being that he'd had overtures from an act in the US to was he interested in managing them? It wasn't that Michael reached out to them, it was they reached out to Michael. But to the Young Brothers, that was seen as, you know, heresy. you're ditching us? He's like, no, not at all. But, you know, to them, they were very protective. You have to understand, too, with the Youngs, there was no plan B. It wasn't like they had a fallback plan as, say, their big brother George did. He knew he was going to get into production. Well, that certainly wasn't the case with Angus and Malcolm. They wanted this thing, AC/DC, to become as big as it possibly could. I think if Bond had gone on to make that record, and I'm pretty sure he was hell-bent on doing it because he befriended some of the guys from bands like Lynyrd Skynyrd, who sort of suited his musical style in a lot of ways, it would have been great to see how it came out, but it also might have been very complicated for Bond within AC/DC if he was out, you know, promoting a solo record. Because if you look back through the history of the band, the only solo efforts that have come out of AC/DC, I think Brian Johnson's done a couple of TV shows. You know, that's pretty much it.
Well, there are so many stories, and I guess your intention in writing the book was to contribute to keeping the legend alive. I mean, it's, as you say, 41 years since he died. He's got a statue in his hometown, which he probably never expected would...
I don't know how he would have reacted to that, to be honest, Bill. You know, it seemed a bit... Statues seem a bit establishment, if you know what I mean. You know, yeah, you're right. There's one in Fremantle as well, and there's one in Kirriemuir where he was raised. So, and there's an annual Bond Fest, certainly was up until the time of COVID, in both Fremantle and Kirriemuir, these week-long festivals of everything Bond, AC/DC related. So, you know, it's more than a cult. It's it's a big... Bond's got his sort of a big business these days. So, yeah, I'm wondering how he would have reacted to all that. You know, I closed the book with this Highway to Hell, which was this big festival in Perth where they closed off part of the highway that he wrote about in the song that leads out of Perth. And 150,000 people were spread along the highway with all these bands playing. And I've been asked a couple of times, how do you think he would have responded? I think he would have stood there and said, oh, yeah, I deserve that. Yeah, I worked for that, you know.
But unfortunately, we could talk rock and roll and Bon Scott all day, I'm sure, but we've run out of time, Jeff. So I'd just like to give you a very special thank you for once again coming on to Dad's on the Air.
No, it's always a pleasure, Bill. Welcome back to the airwaves, too, by the way. It's an honour to be one of your first guests back on the air.
Thank you very much. Look, we'd love to hear from our listeners, too. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email, and we'll be in touch. If you would like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to your favourite podcast app or our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.